Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Janat Jalil, and in the early hours of Wednesday, the 31st of July, these are our main stories. African-American politicians and other Democratic Party lawmakers have protested against President Trump's appearance at an event in Virginia marking 400 years of American democracy. The UN's humanitarian chief has accused the Security Council of ignoring a scorched-earth policy by Russian and Syrian forces in northwestern Syria. Parliament in India has narrowly passed a controversial bill that makes the Muslim practice of instant divorce a criminal offence. Also in this podcast,
tickling the ear with a small electric current could rebalance the nervous system for over 55-year-olds, potentially helping them age more healthily.
So, will electric ear tickling really make you live longer? We'll find out later. President Trump has spoken of the horrors of slavery at an event in Virginia marking 400 years since English settlers established the first local assembly in the New World, a move celebrated as the birth of American democracy. Many Democratic members of the U.S. Congress from Virginia boycotted the speech, accusing the president of racist and xenophobic rhetoric. A local politician heckled Mr. Trump and held a sign reading, "Deport Hate." Our correspondent, Chris Buckler, reports.
In the grounds of historic Jamestown, archaeologists are still unearthing remnants of the past, when Virginia was a colony, not a state. It was here 4 centuries ago that the foundations were laid for what would become America. And David Givens, who's the director of archaeology at the site, says that's history to be celebrated.
Regardless of how you feel about government today, it started here in July 30th, 1619. Those first assembly members sat down. It all happened right here.
But it's a sign of how some feel about government in modern America that the commemorations to mark that moment have ended up in controversy and even a boycott because of the presence of the democratically elected president of the United States.
He does not represent the entire country, not by his actions.
Black Democrats, including Virginia Delegate Dolores McQuinn, refused to attend because of what she claims were his recent racist tweets, including comments about 4 congresswomen of color, in which he suggested they should go back to the countries they came from.
What was said to those 4 women of color, it angered me because I don't feel like he was just talking to those 4 women. He was talking to me.
Mr. Trump's words were particularly sensitive in Jamestown because this summer also marks 400 years since the first documented Africans arrived on these shores.
My ancestors walked down this path that I'm walking on now, enslaved, stripped of their identity, stripped of their culture, their history.
Steve Williams works at the Colonial National Historical Park.
This shows you the progress, right, that I, as an African-American, have the title as a deputy superintendent in charge of making sure that we protect this site, to make sure that our stories are cultivated, preserved, and interpreted.
It was the beginning of a barbaric trade in human lives.
In his speech at Jamestown, Donald Trump made specific reference to that history of slavery, but his speech was interrupted.
Right here in Virginia, your predecessors...
A protester held up signs and said Virginia was their home and that the president could not send them back. And even as Mr. Trump boarded a noisy helicopter to go to Jamestown, he was forced to defend himself against allegations of racism.
I am the least racist person there is anywhere in the world. What I've done for African Americans in 2.5 years, no president has been able to do anything like it.
At the Jamestown settlement, visitors can see what this land used to be like. They walk around recreations of 17th century forts and ships and watch demonstrations by blacksmiths and musketeers. Many here felt Mr. Trump's recent attacks were offensive, but they didn't agree with a boycott of the commemorations.
Just because someone's coming doesn't mean you can boycott. You're still celebrating the birthplace of everything, and it's good to come here and support just Jamestown itself and the community.
And democracy.
And democracy.
Though on the other hand, we can certainly understand the passionate feelings that he is not representing what this country was founded on and the ideals that we hold dear to ourselves.
In Jamestown, you are given a glimpse of the past. And in that history of people and democracy, there may be lessons for America today.
That report by Chris Buckler. Meanwhile, the governor of California, Gavin Newsom, has signed a law to prevent President Trump taking part in the state's Republican presidential primary next March unless he discloses his tax return. Governor Newsom said all U.S. states had a legal and moral duty to do everything in their power to ensure that leaders seeking office met minimal standards. Mr. Trump has refused to make public his tax affairs, saying that they're being audited. The UN humanitarian chief has urged the UN Security Council to take action in Syria to prevent what he says could be the worst humanitarian disaster of the 21st century. Mark Lowcock likened the Russian and Syrian bombing campaign in rebel-held northwestern Syria to a scorched earth policy.
If, for example, you compare satellite photos of Kafr Nabutha, a town in southern Idlib, taken at the end of April and then again at the end of June, which is what analysts at UNISAT, a UN body with capacity in this area, have done, what you see is a level of destruction consistent with a bombing campaign aimed at a scorched earth policy. Almost every building destroyed in a three-month period. Such satellite imagery has shown 17 entire villages almost completely destroyed and emptied.
The UN says nearly 500 civilians have been killed in 3 months of fighting. Amer Gamalo is a resident of Idlib who works for a local humanitarian agency, the Violet Organization.
There was so many shelling, barrel, bombs, all kinds of weapons were used in the attacks. Sarajev City and Martin Oman are all the time targeted by airstrikes and shelling. Hospitals, schools, mosques, even ambulances. Since the end of April, there have been over 440,000 displacements from northern Hama and southern Idlib. Many of them have been evacuated multiple times, some 5-10 times. They were evacuated to a nearby village, and then this village was targeted, and they will flee again to another one.
Our correspondent in New York, Neda Tofik, told me more about this warning about Idlib to the UN Security Council.
What you really heard from the UN's humanitarian chief, Mark Lowcock, is a real sense of frustration. He said that he spoke with the children and a doctor in Idlib, and he asked them, what message would you have for the Security Council? And they said, we are afraid. Please help us. Make it stop. Civilians there in Idlib have nowhere to escape from these barrel bombs. And you heard Mark Lowcock telling the council that 17 villages have been almost completely destroyed. And while he has briefed them time and time again in the last few months as the fighting has escalated, he says, you have ignored our pleas. You have sat and done nothing. And so there was real frustration for him from the inaction of the Security Council, but also the fact that hospitals, I mean, the UN shares the locations of these hospitals with parties to the conflict in hopes that they can protect civilians. Instead, he fears that these hospitals are being targeted with that information.
And we are talking about the last opposition stronghold in Syria, so there's really nowhere for opposition to go to. But Russia is not likely to heed these dire warnings, is it? Because it has failed to do so in the past, and this means that the UN Security Council is powerless to act.
Yeah, as you say, they failed to do this in the past, so that we see civilians, 40% of the civilians in Idlib actually came from other opposition strongholds there. It's the last one now. And what we heard from Russia and the council today was the same attitude they've had throughout this council, saying that Western colleagues are insulting Russia, criticizing Russia. But their whole goal here is to maintain a terrorist enclave in Idlib. They believe that they are there fighting terrorists. What we've heard from the UN is that for every every terrorist who you know, is on a Security Council list of armed groups, there's 100 civilians. And so what we've heard from the United Nations is there's not a proportional response from the Syrian government and Russians to the actual threat there. And Russia holds a veto power, and they are still using that so that the council is paralyzed.
Neda Torfik at the UN in New York. Health officials in the Democratic Republic of Congo say a second case of Ebola has been detected in the eastern city of Goma. The head of Congo's Ebola response team said the case will be treated locally. Gaius Koeni reports.
It is understood the patient traveled hundreds of miles on his journey to Goma, arriving more than 2 weeks ago. But it is only last week that he started developing symptoms. He has now been isolated in a newly built Ebola treatment center. Teams are trying to trace anyone who may have had contact with him and offer them a vaccination. More than 1 million people live in the tightly packed streets of the region's biggest city. Keeping Ebola out of this crucial trading city is essential if the disease is to be stopped from spreading across the region.
Gaius Koeni. Now to India.
Result of the division on adoption of the motion that the bill be passed, subject to correction, Ayes 99, Noes 84, that the motion that the bill be passed is adopted.
Where the Parliament has approved a bill outlawing the Muslim practice of instant divorce. In future, if a Muslim man tries to divorce his wife by saying or writing the word talak 3 times, he could face up to 3 years in jail. The Indian Prime Minister, Narendra Modi, hailed it as a victory for gender equality. But as our South Asia editor, Jill McGivering, explains, the passage of this bill has been a lengthy and controversial process.
It's been a very long, divisive political battle. And I think that's partly why some of the language coming now from the BJP and the Prime Minister in particular sounds delighted, because it is also a political victory as well as a social one. It's partly because there was that precedent set by the Supreme Court 2 years ago when Muslim women put forward a public interest litigation saying that this was unconstitutional. And there was some surprise when the Supreme Court upheld that ruling and declared it unconstitutional, only by 3-2. It was very close. But then basically sort of turned to government and said, well, it's not for us to legislate. You now need to sort this out. The government tried very hard to get its own bill through, but it's taken a long time. It had 2 ordinances it passed, which then it couldn't get Parliament to ratify. It put a bill forward, which it couldn't get through Parliament. The upper house last time got rid of it. It had to water it down a little bit. There are a couple of amendments in now, for example, about the whether it's bailable, issues about who can bring a charge against a man. It needs to be now the wife or her relative. So an attempt to tone it down, and it got some abstention today, and that's how it got it through. Still quite tight numbers, 99 in favour, 84 against.
Now, triple talak has been outlawed for some time in many countries, including neighbouring Bangladesh and Pakistan. So why has India only got round to banning it now?
I think it's partly because of this sensitivity about the need for different religious communities to be allowed to self-govern on social issues. And that certainly has been one of the bases of objections. Some people are saying, look, this shouldn't be a criminal issue. This is a civil contract and it should have a civil solution. We should work with society to sort it out. There are people who have objected to this also on the grounds that basically, they see it as a pro-Hindu government attacking or undermining the freedom of the minority Muslim community at a time of great sensitivity about communal relations, concerns about, for example, the targeting of the Muslim community and issues of sensitivity surrounding that. So that's made it quite a tough nettle, I think, for any government to grasp. But Narendra Modi has gone ahead. He's won the support he needed. And I think he's managed to position himself in celebrating this as a champion of gender equality and doing it in a way that won't offend or upset his own religious conservatives within the Hindu community, which is his vote base.
Jill McGivering. A legal battle has begun here in London between the multi-billionaire ruler of Dubai and his estranged wife over their 2 children. Princess Haya bint Al Hussein fled the United Arab Emirates earlier this year. She's the 3rd member of Sheikh Mohammed bin Rashid Al Maktoum's court to apparently try to run away. She has applied for a wardship order, which, if granted, would make the court responsible for the children's welfare. She's also seeking a non-molestation order for herself. Our reporter, Hanan Razak, was at the High Court here in central London.
Both of them belong to two of the wealthiest and most powerful families in the Arab world. Princess Haya is half-sister of the King of Jordan, and Sheikh Mohammed bin Rashid Al Maktoum is the ruler of Dubai and the Prime Minister of the United Arab Emirates. So both of them actually belong to very wealthy families. They've been married since 2004. They both are known to love horses and horse racing, and they were seen so many times together here at the Ascot horse race events in the UK every year. And for the first time since long time ago, we saw Sheikh Mohammed bin Rashid on his own this year during the Ascot race.
And she is his sixth and most junior wife. So just tell us what happened in court.
There are so many restrictions to a report on the court due to the family law in the UK. But what we know so far is that this case concerns the welfare of their children. We know that Princess Haya has submitted an application for a non-molestation order and another application for protection from forced marriage.
And has there been much coverage of this, do you know, in the Arab world?
You know, Jeanette, here in the UK, there has been a great interest from the media. Of course, it involves two of the wealthiest people around the world. Also, both their families have close ties with the British royal family here. Interestingly enough, in the Arab world, the media didn't speak so much about it, especially Emirati media. They didn't cover it extensively. If you open the national newspapers or TV channels, you won't see this in the news. But there has been a great interest from the people. We've been seeing on Twitter, many people are talking about their relationship since they got married in 2004. The relationships with the royal family here. So many people are talking about this. So many people are interested to see what's going to happen next in this case. And we are waiting to see.
Hanan Razek. Now, the most obvious advice for growing old and remaining healthy is a balanced diet and regular exercise. But researchers at the University of Leeds in Northern England have found a new way to mitigate some of the side effects of ageing. Electric ear tickling. Beth Timmins reports. Why
don't you tickle me? That was some of the song Tickle Me by Randy Newman. And it turns out a tickle behind the ear could be worth even more than the known benefits of a good giggle. Don't we have fun every minute? Scientists found that a short daily tickling therapy delivered for 2 weeks led to both physiological and well-being improvements, including a better quality of life, mood and sleep. They found that tickling the ear with a small electric current could rebalance the nervous system for over 55-year-olds, potentially helping them age more healthily. So why the ear? Our ears act as a gateway to the body's nervous system. One small branch of the so-called vagus nerve can be stimulated via the skin in specific bits of the outer ear. To some people, the therapy feels ticklish. This nerve connects to the heart, lungs and gut, and is also called the wandering nerve because it's long and well-connected. The study was led by Dr. Beatrice Bretherton from the School of Biomedical Sciences at the University of Leeds.
We attach little clips onto the tragus, which is a part of the outer ear, and we administer very small, pain-free electrical impulses.
As we get older, the balance of the body's nervous system goes awry. This makes people more prone to diseases such as heart problems, depression, and anxiety. But Dr. Bretherton's team found that the therapy helped to rebalance the body's nervous system. Some people said that their mood had improved and that they were sleeping better. Dr. Bretherton says that this tickle therapy could help us age more healthily.
The study results are very promising. So for people who are around that kind of age group, it could help prevent the onset of age-related conditions.
Dr. Bretherton said the main plan now is to see if the therapy could benefit particular disorders such as heart failure and depression, and to further investigate both the physiological and psychological benefits of these tiny tickling electric currents.
Beth Timmins. Also in the podcast,
Caster Semenya has always insisted she will never comply with the controversial rule which says she must suppress her natural levels of testosterone.
The South African athlete Caster Semenya says a new court ruling has forced her to withdraw from the Athletics World Championships. In the earlier podcast, we heard that the Chinese government claimed it had released most of the inmates in the infamous so-called education centres in its northwestern province of Xinjiang. 90% of inmates, the vast majority from the mainly Muslim Uyghur ethnic group, have returned to society, according to a news conference in Beijing on Tuesday. But that claim hasn't been independently verified. Many human rights organisations say that these education centres are nothing more than prison camps where it's thought that hundreds of thousands of people are held without trial, and that Chinese Uyghurs face the constant pressure of having their culture and autonomy wiped out by government repression. Peter Irwin works with the World Uyghur Congress, an organisation which criticises the Chinese government's current policies in Xinjiang province. My colleague Razia Iqbal asked him if any members of the organisation have been able to confirm these reports.
I think although it's nearly impossible to confirm the substance of some of the statements that came up from the governor of the region, I think what we do know is that in the past, because of the situation in the Uyghur region, the past couple of years, the Chinese government's made fairly consistent and often demonstrably false claims about it. So, for example, during the press conference, Shuaib Zakir said that Uyghurs were allowed to go home regularly, they can practice religion at home. This is in fairly direct contradiction to legislation that was passed in 2017, explicitly banning things like men growing beards, women wearing the hijab, children's names were even banned. So I think we have every reason to be deeply skeptical about this, but we're watching it fairly carefully nonetheless.
When you say you're watching it carefully, has anyone, any members of your organization got in touch to say, yes, there's some movement, something's happening?
At this point, no. So I think that's going to be a pretty key indicator, is that if this is true, if this is the case, that what will happen, Uyghurs in the diaspora likely will be able to then contact their relatives who live in the region. We haven't seen that yet, but well, I guess we'll just have to watch and see. Again, we're quite skeptical of what the governor said today, but we'll just have to see.
There has, of course, been a huge amount of criticism. You know, Western governments have become increasingly vocal about these sweeping detentions. Many media organizations attempting to do investigations. The BBC has done several investigations. If there is a release of prisoners, what do you think would be the rationale behind it?
Well, I think part of the rationale, if you want to get inside the heads of the Communist Party leaders in the region, for one thing, you can't lock up 10% of the population arbitrarily forever, of course. The facilities need to be closed at a certain point. But I think key to realize, too, is that they've built, as BBC has reported on, quite an extensive network of very large facilities. You see satellite imagery showing them across the region. So the questions remain, so what are these facilities going to operate as in the future? I think at the moment, and as the camps have been open for so long, they serve a disciplinary function for Uyghurs outside of the facilities, where people are afraid to essentially do anything to express themselves for fear of being put into these places. So if these facilities still exist, these large facilities, I mean, likely they'll continue to be used, but potentially in different ways. So you've seen the transition from essentially a prison where people are forced to learn sort of Communist Party doctrine and praise Xi Jinping and things like this. You've seen a transition in some ways to more things like forced labor, for example.
Peter Irwin from the World Uyghur Congress. The US-based financial services company Capital One has revealed the personal details of more than 100 million individuals in North America have been stolen. The hacked data includes names, addresses, and phone numbers of people who applied for credit card products. The US Justice Department says a former software engineer with a Seattle-based technology company has been arrested in connection with a breach and charged with computer fraud. Anna Maria Andriotis reports on credit cards for the Wall Street Journal, and she told Matthew Davies that the scale and nature of the breach is extremely worrying.
This is a very serious attack for two reasons. Number one, the sheer number of people who've been impacted by it, approximately 106 million card customers and applicants. Secondly, what makes this very serious and in some ways unprecedented is the scope of data that was accessed. In some ways, people have become kind of numb, at least in the U.S., to their names, addresses, dates of birth, social security numbers, that sort of personally identifying information being accessed. But with this breach, not only was much of that data accessed, but so was financially related information such as people's credit scores, their credit card spending limits, their income, their payment histories. This is information that fraudsters, if they have access to it, can do quite a bit of damage with.
It's also the kind of information, social security numbers, obviously your name, your phone numbers. It's that sort of information that you can't change in the same way that you might be able to change a PIN number or a password.
That is correct. Having this information in addition to people's names, etc., essentially gives fraudsters the ability to say, okay, we know whose identities we can take over and have a good shot at getting approved for a credit card or have a good shot at getting a big spending limit. So this is really a vast treasure trove of data that has been accessed. The types of data stolen here, there's nothing typical about this.
Anna Maria Andriotis from the Wall Street Journal. The Duke of Sussex, Prince Harry, has spoken out against unconscious bias, saying that prejudice is learned and that unless it's acknowledged, people are always going to be fighting against it. In an interview in the September edition of Vogue, which his wife Meghan has guest edited, the prince also said that the couple were only going to have two children for the sake of the planet. Our royal correspondent Nicholas Witchell has more.
The Duke made his comments during an interview he conducted with Dr. Jane Goodall, a conservationist and chimpanzee expert, for the September edition of the magazine Vogue, which his wife, the Duchess of Sussex, has guest edited. Harry tells Dr. Goodall that he views the natural world differently since the birth of his son Archie. Dr. Goodall asked how many children he and his wife intended to have. Two maximum, the Duke replied. Harry's brother William and his wife Catherine, of course, have three children. Harry also asked Dr. Goodall how her study of primates had affected the way she felt about people. They talked about violence and racism, and Harry spoke about unconscious bias passed down from generation to generation, where a person's words or actions could be perceived as racist, though if challenged, the person would deny it. Contributory factors, Harry suggested, were the way a person had been brought up and the environment in which they'd lived.
Nicholas Witchell. The South African double Olympic champion Caster Semenya says she will miss the Athletics World Championships later this year after a Swiss court ruling which effectively blocked her from racing. Semenya has naturally high levels of testosterone and has appealed against a decision by the governing body of World Athletics not to let her compete in women's races unless she takes testosterone-lowering drugs. Alex Capstick reports.
Caster Semenya has always insisted she will never comply with the controversial rule which says she must suppress her natural levels of testosterone. It's aimed at female athletes described as having differences of sexual development who compete in events from 400 metres to a mile. Last month she was given a reprieve when a judge temporarily suspended the regulation pending the result of her appeal to the Swiss courts. That has now been reversed following a request by the sport's governing body, the IAAF. In a statement, Semenya said she was disappointed to be kept from defending her title, but she would continue her fight for the human rights of all female athletes concerned.
Alex Capstick reporting there. And that's all from us for now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this edition or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Jeanette Jalil. Until next time, goodbye. Thank you.